Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
It's February 15th, 2016, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 9, Brahma's Prayers for Creative Energy, Text 34. Nana karma vitanena.
Nana karma vacharena.
Prajabhavi sikshikshata. Natma vasidatasminste. Varshiyan madanugraha. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Since you have desired to increase the population innumerably and expand your varieties of service, you shall never be deprived in this matter because my causeless mercy upon you will always increase for all time. Purport. A pure devotee of the Lord, being cognizant of the facts of the particular time, object, and circumstances, always desires to expand the number of devotees of the Lord in various ways. Such expansions of transcendental service may appear to be material to the materialist, but factually they are expansions of the causeless mercy of the Lord toward the devotee. Plans for such activities may appear to be material activities, but they are different in potency, being engaged in the satisfaction of the transcendental senses of the Supreme. Nana karma vitanena praja bhavi shikrikshita natma vasidat yashmin te varshiyan mad anugraha. Since you have desired to increase the population innumerably and expand your varieties of service, you shall never be deprived in this matter because my causeless mercy upon you will always increase for all time. Wow, something that always increases for all time. Not like matter that always decreases. So here Prabhupada says, engage in satisfaction of the transcendental senses of the Supreme. We talk a lot in the Hare Krishna movement about pleasing Krishna's senses, transcendental sense gratification of Krishna. I think in every religion they talk a lot about pleasing the Lord. You know, what does that mean, to please the Lord? So here Krishna is talking about what pleases him. He's saying, always expanding, what does he say? Desire to increase the population innumerably. Of course, Lord Brahma is not interested just in increasing the population like, you know, spiders. Or some, you know, what, seahorses have like 1,500 babies at a time. So he's not talking about simply having lots and lots and lots of children, but engaging them in devotional service, increasing unlimitedly the facility for living entities to regain their original Krishna conscious position. And of course, Krishna also says in the Bhagavad Gita that there's no servant more dear to him than one who is helping others to be Krishna conscious, increasing the family. It's interesting, the other day I saw a doctor, someone that I hadn't seen before, and several times he talked to me just about his family, how proud he was of his family and how happy he was that he had his own family and his own children. And this is natural. That Prabhupada talks about, why does a person get married and have children? To increase their pleasure. And he compares this natural desire of a human being to the desire of the Lord, that the Lord has expanded into so many living entities for pleasure. Prabhupada was asked in South America, why is there anything? Why does anything exist? And he said, ananda, for happiness. So being happy alone is not very satisfying, isn't it? I mean, who is really alone, even if someone is, you know, alone? When I was a kid, I used to like to just sit out in the forest. But I wasn't really alone. I mean, there were the trees and the insects and the birds and the squirrels and so forth. I wasn't alone. And Krishna is never alone. And nowadays, when people are happy, so-called alone, what are they doing? They're playing a computer game, they're watching some show, some movie, they're reading a book. And so they're virtually, they're on social media, so they're virtually with others. They're not just alone. Of course, there are those who think that their perfection is to be alone, to merge into the Brahman. And even that's not a sense of alone. They want to become one with the whole, and they don't want to be just alone. That's not pleasing. So what's the most pleasing to Krishna's senses, what gives him the most happiness, is when he can enjoy along with the living entities, and when he can give the living entities pleasure. When we say we want to enjoy by having a family, by having friends, we don't just talk about what enjoyment they can give us, but we're thinking about what enjoyment we can give them, how we're giving enjoyment to each other and enjoying with them. So that's a little indication of what Krishna wants. In fact, Krishna doesn't need, we talk about this a lot, Krishna doesn't need to take enjoyment from the living entities. After all, he is complete and unlimited and expanding. Here his mercy is expanding. Everything about him is expanding. And whatever the living entities have to offer him, he is giving them. Krishna asks for patram pushpam palam toyam. Yome bhakti prachitita raham bhakti paritam ashnami praidatmana. But where are we getting the flowers from? I can't create a flower. I can't create water. I can't create a leaf. These are things that Krishna has. So it's not even the love that I have. It's explained in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that if I try to generate my own love for Krishna, it's not going to work. It's going to be an illusion. I have to be filled with the pleasure potency of the Lord. I have that ray of the pleasure potency of the Lord has to come to me. Otherwise, I can't. I don't have anything to offer. So like Krishna has to give me a flower before I can offer him a flower. He has to give me water before I can offer him water. Krishna has to give me the pleasure potency before I can give him pleasure. So it's not that Krishna is wanting to enjoy the living entities in a material, mundane sense. Krishna has no lust in that way. Krishna wants to enjoy with the living entities, to give them pleasure, to share his pleasure. It's like most people, unless they're misers like, you know, Scrooge and Dickens' Christmas Carol, if they have something nice, they want to share it with others. This is the natural propensity, especially if they have far more than they can use for themselves. Like these very rich people who become big philanthropists because they say, well, I can't spend all my money. You know, if you have more food than you can eat, then naturally you want to share it with somebody else. You don't simply want it to rot. Of course, Krishna's things are not going to rot. But this is the mood that Krishna has. He's unlimited, he's ever expanding, and he wants to share that joy, he wants to share that knowledge, he wants to share that with living entities, and the more living entities that are sharing with him, the happier that he is. So his happiness increases and increases the more he can share. You know, materially we have this sense of want and need and insufficiency, and therefore we don't really want to share unlimitedly. You know, okay, well, I'll give charity, but not everything. Then what will be left for me? I remember my mother used to say, don't give so much charity that you become an object of charity. So that's our mood materially, but Krishna being unlimitedly expanding, he doesn't have that kind of mood. So the best way to please Krishna's senses is to facilitate more and more living entities to be enjoying with him. You know, it's like Krishna's having this big party, and the best way we can make him happy is increasing the invitee list, increasing the list of people who's coming to the party. And nothing pleases Krishna more. I mean, after all, anything else that we offer him, it's really just a symbol of our love. The thing in itself doesn't really have value, right? I mean, you offer Krishna a flower, what value is there in the flower for Krishna? Or the drop of water, not really, nothing. But when you facilitate other living entities to come to Krishna, of course we could say when you're offering a flower, you're benefiting the soul and the body of the plant that had the flower, but I think you understand the point. If you bring other living entities to Krishna, that's something that really has value, because those living entities were in this illusion of separateness. So you're really bringing Krishna something meaningful. As we've discussed before, it's not that Krishna is lacking because there's billions and billions of living entities who are not surrendering to him. He's unlimited and flowing over, and he's the reservoir, Kila Rasamrita Murti. He's the reservoir of all tastes and flavors. It's not that someone can deny him something. But at the same time, one could say that he's not being given the facility to share that in the way that he would like with those living entities. He certainly is sharing and facilitating with those living entities, even in illusion, isn't he? Even if I'm enjoying an illusion, like Prabhupada said, you tell the alcoholic that Krishna is the taste of his alcohol. Anything that anyone is enjoying, any rasa, no matter how demoniac or perverted or evil or sinful, that rasa is coming from Krishna. Prabhupada talked about the ghastly rasa. He said, if you want to really enjoy the ghastly rasa, you meditate on Lord Nisingadev. But he said, even, you know, the murderers, the butchers, they're trying to enjoy a ghastly rasa. And their ability to get any kind of pleasure from their activities is coming from Krishna. So the point is that Krishna is sharing rasa, even with the rebellious living entities, but it's not in a way that's really pleasing to them. So what's most pleasing to Krishna is when they're pleased. Krishna wants to see that everyone else is pleased. Something like if you really want to please someone, you please their children. And when they see that their children are pleased, then they'll be very pleased. So how do we do this? How do we, there's really three things here that really kind of jump out of the verse and the purport as far as how can we preach in a way, how can we bring living entities to Krishna in a way that will really please his senses and be most pleasing to him. Unfortunately, the word preach has come to a kind of negative connotation, and there's a lot of devotees now who recommend that we use other words, you know, outreach or sharing or... although Srila Prabhupada often uses the word preach. So here, looking at the first one, it says, a pure devotee of the Lord, being cognizant of the facts of the particular time, object, and circumstance. Particular time, object, and circumstance. I was just hearing Srila Prabhupada say today that a doctor will give you the best medicine for you and at this particular time. So often if you're getting medical treatment, you may get a certain treatment on week one and another treatment on week two. Right? You're working with a physical therapist, they'll have you do one exercise now and another exercise as you get stronger. And they'll give you a different set of exercises than for someone else. I had a physical therapist once give me a sheet of exercises, and she circled some and she X'd out others. And she said, don't do these. She said, these will make it worse. So it was a generic list of exercises, but not all of them were going to be suitable for me. So this idea of the particular time, object, and circumstances, or time, place, and circumstances, or person, is so important for preaching. I mean, it just cannot be overemphasized. And we have a serious problem with knowing what's a principle and what's a detail. You know, the people known as the arch conservatives, they basically think, you know, everything's a principle. Nothing should ever be changed. There's practically no details for them. And the arch liberals, you know, everything's a detail. There's no principles. And Burjan Prabhu asked Srila Prabhupada, how do you know what's an eternal principle that can't be changed and what's one that should be or must be changed? And Prabhupada said that requires intelligence. So what are the eternal principles that can never be changed, or you lose the siddha anta, the end of perfection? And what are the details that not only can be changed, but absolutely must be changed? For example, we have an offense on chanting not to preach the glories of the holy name to the faithless. So this offense implies that one is changing one's preaching, one is changing one's teaching, according to the other person's level of cognizance and the other person's level of receptivity, according to the other person's level of faith. So if you tell something to someone that's way above their level of faith, then you'll simply increase their doubts and their skepticism and their resistance. I need to tell people things that they're ready to accept. I remember there was one woman who was visiting our temple at Bhaktivedanta Manor in the UK on a regular basis. And her husband was an atheist and really opposing her interest in anything spiritual. And she asked me if I could help him. So she brought him to the temple and I spoke with him, and I just focused on, we're not this body. Srila Prabhupada, at least in one occasion, asked the devotees, what's the first point you make in preaching? And they said, there is a God. He said, no, that you're not this body. So I talked about how you're not this body, and I talked about it entirely from empirical evidence. I didn't use anything from the Shastra. He was a Westerner. He doesn't know what is the Bhagavad Gita, what is the Srimad Bhagavatam. Even if he knew, it had no value for him. He didn't consider it as authoritative, right? What would he consider as authoritative? Something that was scientific. So I took, you know, different scientific examples. And then he started at least questioning. He got, by the end of the conversation, to at least an open-mindedness. Maybe there's something beyond the body and the mind. And this principle, again, is extremely important. Otherwise, if you use sources and arguments that are beyond the person, they'll resist them. They'll fight them, and then they're harmed. Then they're committing an offense. For some people, all you can do is give them prasadam. Right? People have to hear from an authority that they accept. I remember years ago, I was trying to speak to one woman about something with health, and I was trying to convince her, and I was giving her books and videos and so forth and so on, and I was getting nowhere. And then, interestingly enough, someone at the hospital that she was going to ended up telling her the same thing that I had been telling her, and because she heard it from a person in the hospital, then she immediately accepted it. Okay, that is a fact. Psychological research has been shown that the only way you change people's minds is through stories and through them hearing from some authority that they already respect. Yad yad acharati shrestas. So what's the time, place, and circumstance? Who are the authorities that people accept? Just like the former Beatle George Harrison, he made this song, My Sweet Lord, with the chanting of Hare Krishna. And so many people, I mean, I was just a secondary school student, a teenager, young teenager at the time. And immediately I thought, oh, George Harrison likes Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna must be good. Immediately, without doing any investigation on my own at that time. He likes it, it must be good. So that's the, according to time, place, and circumstance, you approach persons with Krishna consciousness in a way that they're going to be receptive to, in some way that they will accept. I remember in the Detroit Temple, used to be the mansion of Fisher, as body by Fisher in the car industry, and there was one devotee there who would take a prasadam ladus and go to the people on the tours and just put the ladus in their hands without even a plate or a napkin or anything. And they'd have this sticky, you know, ladu in their hands. And we were giving the tours, you know, sort of sophisticated. We were wearing silk saris and so forth. And we would bring in Krishna consciousness to the tours, but we weren't advertising it as a tour of Krishna consciousness, so to speak. And he would just come and put these sticky, buttery things in their hands and kind of look at it and, well, you know, what do I do with it? And, you know, and it would really just make the people inimical to Krishna consciousness, right? There's one devotee just posted something that his daughter, a 17-year-old daughter, you know, was born a devotee, so she's out and about in the city. And some other devotee pressures her to buy some of Srila Prabhupada's books. And she said, listen, I'm a devotee. My parents are devotees. I have all the books in my house. I don't need them. And he pressured her and pressured her and pressured her. And basically, you know, till she ended up giving him a donation. And she comes home and complains to her father. And her father was saying, you know, this is not the proper way to deal with someone. So time, place, and circumstance. What's my relationship with the person? Do they see me as authority? Who will they see as an authority? What are they willing to take? What are they not willing to take? And to force something on someone that they're not open and willing to take is an offense. And Lord Brahma is very expert at this time, place, and circumstance. If we really think about it, he's putting each living entity, we discussed this in previous verses, in exactly the right body and exactly the right planet, and giving them exactly the right opportunities so that they can somehow or other try to progress spiritually according to their own personal proclivity, and how expert he must be in order to do that. So what a wonderful service Lord Brahma has. And the Uttama Adhikari, in fact, looks at the world and says, everything is perfect. Everything is perfect. There's nothing more that needs to be done. Therefore, the Uttamadhikari doesn't preach because he sees, you know, it's all taken care of. You know, if you go someplace and you see, oh, everybody's already taken care of everything, you know, Krishna and his servants are already on top of everything, nothing for them to do. And the next category is expanding transcendental service, expanding the varieties of service. So service is not narrow or stereotyped. It's not monolithic. It's not that there's only one kind of service to do. And so a guru like Lord Brahma, the head of the Sampradaya, he's engaging living entities in all different varieties of service. And there's many religious systems that basically says, okay, everybody has to do exactly this in the same way, and everyone has to do this in this life. But the Vedic literatures are vast and complex and individualized of the varieties of service that one can do. And Srila Prabhupada says that this expansion, what does he say? Such expansions of transcendental service may appear to be material to the materialist, but factually they are expansions of the causeless mercy of the Lord toward the devotee. So one may say, oh, why is this person doing dramas about Krishna? This person is doing dances about Krishna, and this person is cooking, and this person is publishing books. And we will find that even among the devotees, people may take their own area of service and really push that everyone has to do my own area of service. And they think, well, I'm taking care of cows, everyone should take care of cows, you know, I'm distributing books all day, everybody should be doing that all day as their main service, and I'm distributing prasadam, everyone should be distributing prasadam. Because they see things as material. Right? They're not saying that there's an infinite variety of individuals. Or they may see things as material because a lot of the ways we offer service in our conditioned state is according to our particular situation in the modes of nature. So if I'm more situated in goodness, then, you know, if my body and mind are more situated in goodness, then the way that I offer service will be more in goodness. If my body and mind are more situated in ignorance, then the way that I'm going to offer service is going to be different. And therefore, we have Chaturvanya Mayashristam Guna Karma Bhagasha Tasyam Kartam Abhimam Vijikartam Abhyam. And Krishna is saying, I have these different varnas, these different colors. And he says one can attain perfection, siddhi, he says. One can attain perfection by serving the Lord according to one's nature. And in fact, Krishna says that what will repression accomplish? And he says, even if you appear to be expert at doing someone else's job, if it's not really your nature to do it, it's not just a matter of external expertise. It's what brings you happiness and joy, what really makes you feel alive, what is your actual nature. You know, you might be able to use a computer for a doorstop, but that's not its, you know, it may do a great job as a doorstop. Maybe your computer does a better job at holding open the door than, you know, a rock. But if you use the computer for holding open a door, the computer's going to get ruined. So therefore, people may think that the service we're doing is material because it's according to our material body and mind. I mean, of course, we all do some service that's not dependent on the material body and mind, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam. Those are all not dependent on the kind of body and mind that one has. But beyond that, most of us are doing service beyond that, although we might put it into the category of Dasyam or Apadasevanam. And we're doing according to our nature. What do we like to do? Are we a friendly, outgoing person? Are we an introverted person? Are we a person who likes a lot of change and variety? Are we a person who likes a lot of regulation? Are we very cautious? Are we very risk-taking? So we have a particular nature. Right? And it is a material nature. It isn't our eternal nature. So in this world, maybe one may be very outgoing and very loud, but maybe in the spiritual world, you're just a little quiet gopi, you know? Some 10-year-old gopi in the background. So it is material, but being used in the service of the Lord, it is not material. It's like the metal that's put in touch with fire and becomes hot like fire. You put the pot on the stove and the pot becomes as hot as the stove. It becomes spiritualized. as Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita 4:24. Everything, the person offering, what's being offered, the consumption, everything becomes absolute. So a materialistic person looks at it and says, well, yeah, you know, that's really material, that you're serving in this way and you're serving in this way. It's just according to your material nature. And they don't see, but that's what Krishna's asking. After all, if we're going to surrender to Krishna, we have to surrender ourselves to Krishna. Manasa deha geha yo kichimura. Arpila tuva pari nanda kishore. Atmanivedanam, surrendering the self, doesn't just mean the soul. It also means the body. Bhumirarpanalo vayu kamano buddharevacha. These are all Krishna's energies to be used in his service. And I have to engage my body and mind according to what body and mind that I have. I can't artificially engage my body and mind as if it's somebody else's body and mind. I can't have a human body and engage in Krishna's service like it's a dog body. You know, if I have a, whether my body's young or old or female or male, what language I speak and so forth. I have to engage that in Krishna's service. So it's not really material. And in fact, Prabhupada says, factually, he says, expansions of the causeless mercy of the Lord. And we each experience this, that as we engage even our mundane nature in Krishna's service, we feel an increasing empowerment by the Lord. Isn't it? Now, we should say here that each of our mundane natures has a downside. As Krishna says, every endeavor has some fault, like smoke is covering fire. And the fault finders, they look, you know, this is some fault, you know. Just like I was reading the other day, one of these criticizers, oh, how can women perform dances and dramas in front of a, you know, mixed audience, in front of men? But Srila Prabhupada was very pleased with that. Prabhupada was so pleased with Rasagya, who was in the theater, and many other lady devotees who were in theaters in front of mixed audiences, who were doing street dramas. And I was there, sitting behind Srila Prabhupada in the theater, when he was so pleased. And someone might say, oh, this is a fault, that some woman is on stage playing the goddess of fortune, Sita, and there's sannyasis in the audience. Srila Prabhupada himself was in the audience. Oh, that's some fault. But every activity has some fault. You cannot do an activity in this world without fault. Are you ever going to have fire without smoke? Not possible. That's not possible. So because there's some fault in our activities, we may sometimes just want to retire from them. Not only we maybe criticize others' activities as being mundane, but we may want to say, well, I don't really want to do that service for Krishna because it has some sort of fault. But Krishna says, better to be destroyed doing your own nature than to do someone else's nature, even if you think it can be done perfectly. And we see that when we do things according to our nature, even though there is fault, not if there's fault, definitely there's fault, still we feel this increase of Krishna's mercy on us. The more that we connect authentically with Krishna, both our real self and our external self, our temporary false self, the more we do that authentically, then the more Krishna's mercy on us expands and expands and expands. We become empowered to use that nature for Krishna. And someone, again, may look at that and say, oh, you're just, you know, you're getting money, you're getting followers, this is all material. But, although it could be, that to the devotee who's really connected with Krishna, it isn't material at all. It's the pouring of the Lord's mercy. And then Prabhupada mentions plans for such activities. Last thing he says, plans for such activities may appear to be material activities, but they are different in potency, being engaged in the satisfaction of the transcendental service of the Supreme. So Srila Prabhupada in other places define sense gratification as making plans. And that's exactly what materialistic people do. Materialistic people are always making plans for how to satisfy their senses. I'm going to buy this thing. I'm going to go to this place. I'm going to meet this person. And when I do these things, then I will enjoy. Right? Prabhupada talks about this as lust, that lust is always making plans for how I'm going to enjoy, how am I going to have my bodily and mental senses satisfied. So do we just give up plans? Do we just become like, well, I'm just going to go with the flow. All right, well, that's higher than the mode of passion. If someone just says, I'm just going to be equibalanced and equipoised and just peaceful and not endeavor for anything in the world. But in bhakti, we make plans to please Krishna. And someone can look at it and say, well, that's rajagun. Look how hard you're working. Look how hard you're working mentally to make these plans, drawing up a blueprint for a temple. Like Prabhupada says, we shouldn't build some big palatial building for our family members. Of course, if you already have one, I know a devotee who's very wealthy, and when he became a devotee, he already had a palatial building. I visited his building in India, and I thought they had one apartment in an apartment building, but the whole building was there. So he already had a palatial building, and his spiritual master said to him, well, don't get rid of it, use it. Use it for preaching programs and inviting dignitaries and so forth. Right. So anyway, Prabhupada says, don't build a palatial building for your family members, but you can build a gorgeous temple for Krishna. We can build the temple of the Vedic Planetarium, the Krishna Balaram Temple, the Juhu Temple, so many beautiful temples that we build for Krishna to attract the public and, again, to bring people to Krishna consciousness. And someone may say, well, this is really material. You know, you're interested just in this big building and you're worrying about money and this and that. But it's not. Because we're trying to satisfy the senses of Krishna. And from Krishna's perspective, there is nothing material. What's material is something that's separate from Krishna. And in fact, Srila Prabhupada says that by making plans to spread Krishna consciousness, by making plans to help people love Krishna, that we conquer our own lust. Because now I'm making plans to satisfy Krishna's senses instead of making plans to satisfy my own senses. Well, some of you looking at today's purport, being a little astute, might say, all right, Urmila, but you forgot about the very first part of the purport. And the very first part of the purport changes everything, right? Those first six words, a pure devotee of the Lord. So maybe all of this only applies to the pure devotee. Maybe none of this applies to me at all. You know, maybe when I'm working out time, place, and circumstance, and maybe when I'm expanding the varieties of service people can offer, and maybe when I'm making all these plans for preaching, maybe it's all about ego. I'm thinking about producing another book based on Manashiksha, and I was looking at some of the traditional religious analogies books, was looking at Pilgrim's Progress. And at one point, one of the naysayers approaches the main pilgrim and says to him, everything you do is for vain glory. Everything you do is just for your own glorification. Indeed, in Manashiksha, Raghunath Das Goswami talks about that the last anarta, the deepest anarta, the most disguised anarta, and the most difficult to recognize, the most difficult to root out, is this desire for fame, this desire for glory. And in the ultimate issue, it becomes wanting glory for being a devotee, wanting glory for knowing the shastras, wanting glory for being a big preacher. And one can say, well, how am I a pure devotee? I have this desire for fame and honor. Right? Just the third verse of the Shikshastaka, Manina Manidena Kirtaniya Sadahari. But I don't really want to honor others. I want honor for myself. I still have this contamination. So it's very nice. Srila Prabhupada, in a lecture on the Nectar Devotion given on November 4th, 1972 in Vrindavan, he said, pure devotee is anyone who has no other motive except to serve Krishna. It doesn't matter he's first class, second class, or third. Anyabhilasita sunyam. If he has got some motive, then he's not pure devotee. He may be not advanced, but if he has not motive, then he's pure devotee. If he wants to utilize Krishna for his personal benefit, then he's not pure devotee, he's impure. So first of all, he has to become pure devotee. So this is a very astonishing quote. Prabhupada said, doesn't matter if he's first class, second class, or third class, he may be not advanced, Prabhupada says, but if he has not motive, then he's pure devotee. And you can say, well, I thought being not advanced means that I have some motive. Isn't that what it means? How can I be not advanced and at the same time say I have no motive? What does that mean? What does it mean to be a pure devotee? You know, often we think, well, pure devotee means only prema bhakti, because even bhava bhakti, there is something. It's not fully developed. Or certainly one has to be at least bhava to be a pure devotee. But the point is at least one's overall intention. So the desires for this vain glory, for vanity and glory, they're certainly going to persist until the stage of bhava. There's no question about it. They will. And far more gross things will be there for those in the beginning stages. That will be there. The anarthas will be there when one starts bhakti. One is filled with anarthas. And one's filled with anarthas of which one is not even aware. And cannot be made aware forcefully. You cannot go up to somebody and just say, hey, you got this anartha. But yet we can say pure devotees. Like Prabhupada said, the mango, unripe mango, ripe mango. You can even use the unripe mango. You can even use the mango peels, right, to make pickles. Prabhupada would do that. It's all good. You know, the unripe papaya they make into a vegetable preparation here. It doesn't have to, it's still a papaya. It's not something else. It's still a mango. It doesn't become an apple just because it's unripe. So what does it mean to be a pure devotee even in an unadvanced stage? It means my aspiration is to do nothing but to satisfy Krishna. That I'm not intentionally, consciously, maliciously using Krishna for my own purposes. Those are indeed my inner hidden motives. I have inner hidden motives. Must, if I'm not pure. I mean, if I'm not advanced, the definition is I have inner hidden motives. But I want to get rid of them. What does it say? One should not maintain material attachments even after understanding so many instructions on this matter. So the desire of one who's a pure devotee is they want to get rid of these inner motives. They want to get rid of these contaminations. They want to come to the point of only wanting to please Krishna, and they're coming to Krishna, at least ostensibly, simply to please Krishna. Not the same as someone who goes to a temple, a church, a mosque, whatever, for the purpose of asking for money, for the purpose of asking for a nice spouse. Now, of course, as we say many times, one should be honest with Krishna about what one wants, and one should certainly go to Krishna for them with regret. Kardama Muni gives a very nice example. And in fact, we can compare and contrast Kardama Muni with Daksha. So Kardama Muni wanted a nice wife. And when Lord Vishnu came, he said, you know, the really intelligent persons don't ask you for anything in this world, but I want a compatible wife. And of course, Kardama Muni wanted a compatible wife because he had a service given to him by Lord Brahma, as we're reading about in today's verse, of expanding the varieties of living entities and their service to Krishna. So it was certainly part of his service to generate children, to increase the population. But frankly, he also wanted a nice compatible wife. He wanted a wife of like disposition. And Prabhupada explains there that if we go to the Lord with our desires will be fulfilled beyond our expectations. But Kardama Muni having a nice wife, a compatible wife, a wonderful wife, amazing wife, Devahuti, the daughter of Swayambhuva Manu, didn't impede his becoming Krishna conscious because he went to Krishna with that desire, and he went to Krishna with that desire honestly. That he said, I shouldn't have this desire. I wish I didn't have this desire. I wish I only desired to serve you, but I do have this desire. Please help me fulfill it in a way that will glorify you. So that is the way we should approach Krishna with our desires. Now, in contrast, we look at Daksha in his life as the son of the Prachetas. So he also was supposed to increase the population. That was also his job, to generate innumerable living entities. And frankly, he did engage them in worship of Vishnu when his sons, the Haryashvas and the Sakalashvas, I forget their names, when they went off to perform their austerities, they were doing austerities meditating on Vishnu. In fact, Daksha had been meditating on Vishnu himself. But Daksha's aim was not ultimate bhakti. That was not his aim. Yes, he wanted to do things in the Lord's service. He didn't want to do things as a demon. But his aim was to enjoy the world by the blessings of the Lord. Kardama Muni's aim was to come to pure devotional service. And he knew, I need this support right now. I'm not going to be able to come to pure devotional service as a renunciate. I have to go through the Grihastha Ashram. And such is the case for the vast majority of living entities. We've seen so many times people trying to go to the renounced ashrams in youth and they simply fall on their face. So most living entities need to go through the grahastha ashram. But if one's going through the grahastha ashram because, Krishna, this is what I need right now, I'm sorry that this is what I need, but it's what I need. But I'm only going to depend on you for this. I'm not going to go outside of you to get this need taken care of. Whereas Daksha's mood was, I want to enjoy the world. I'm not trying to come to pure devotional service, and I want to use the Lord to enjoy the world. And interestingly enough, when Lord Vishnu came, Daksha experienced bhava. I mean, not like the demons, you know, when Krishna comes, they just experience anger and envy. I'm going to kill him. Wow, you know, Daksha wasn't like that. He experienced bhava. He got a chance. Lord Vishnu gave him a chance. Here's a little taste of what it could be like to attain the highest perfection. After all, he was the son of the Prachetas, who were all pure devotees, disciples of Lord Shiva, Narada. In his previous birth, he was a direct son of Lord Brahma. But because he had an ill motive, because ultimately he wanted to use the Lord, he had no respect for those persons who were situated on a transcendental platform. He couldn't even understand them. They didn't make sense to him. In fact, the persons on the transcendental platform appeared to him to be spoiling the principles of religion because his vision was at this lower level. So therefore, he blasphemed Shiva, who was his own son-in-law, and then he blasphemed Narada, who had done the greatest favor. I mean, his whole idea was to increase the population. Why? So that they would become Krishna conscious. So he created all these 10,000, 1,000 sons. Narada Muni made them all Krishna conscious. Now he had, 11,000 sons who all became pure devotees. If his real motive was to increase the population, to engage them in service, then he would have been very happy. But instead, he wanted them to be, pious materialists. So being a pure devotee, even in an unadvanced stage, means that one has the goal of pure devotional service. And one of the main evidences for whether or not we have this goal is how we think about and treat those who are on a higher platform than ourselves. You know, I've noticed that there's a tendency among some members, even of the Krishna Conscious Society, to fix on mundane dharma and to criticize anybody who does anything in transcendence that's not exactly the same as mundane dharma. So that sort of mentality is indicative of not being anyabhilasita sunya. Such people want to use the Lord simply to improve their material condition. So if we want to satisfy the senses of the Lord, have this mood that I want to satisfy the senses of the Lord, not just to use him, but just to make him happy for no other reason than to make him happy. And the best way to make him happy is to be aware of the time, place, and circumstance. To expand all the varieties of service according to individual proclivities and needs and desires. And to engage our mind and intelligence in making plans for those activities. And that's something, anybody can do that. Anybody can do it. It can be done on a very simple level. I'm going to make plans for, distributing Simply Wonderfuls. It can be on a very advanced level. I'm going to make plans to have, university departments about Krishna consciousness. But whatever it may be, in this way we please the transcendental senses of the Lord. And then the Lord's mercy upon us expands unlimitedly in quality, quantity, and in all space and time. So questions, comments?
Yes. Can I turn my screen on my coming on?
You're kind of fading in and out.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to ask about the term preaching we talked about earlier. It's
muted.
You just got muted.
Okay. That term, other than in the association of Vaishnavas, I always find myself using terms like sharing, etc.
Mm.
What happened? Dharma preaching, it's so much a part of our mission. Lord Chaitanya ordered Jari Dako Tari Kopa Krishna Vipadesh Amara Gyai by his order. Amara Gyai Guru Gyai Tari Desh. Lord Chaitanya wanted us to preach, you know, everywhere, all around the world, to everyone we meet, whether they're a fit candidate or unfit candidate. What happened to that term? And what do you use?
Well, Lord Chaitanya wasn't speaking in English. He was speaking in Bengali. And the English word that one uses is going to change, again, according to particular time, object, and circumstances. So language changes, and words that are good and appropriate at one time and place may have their meanings changed at another time and place. Just like if you read Shakespeare, you may think you're understanding something, but he may have used a word in with a very different sense of meaning than we would use it today, and you may get a wrong meaning out of it. So although the word preach has some objective meaning, it also has some negative connotation, and that has to be taken into account. If we present things to people without consideration of time, place, and object, then we can do damage. Just like one devotee who's physically older than I am was writing something, and this devotee was not using gender-neutral language. This devotee was using all just he and him and so forth. And I said to this devotee, so who's your audience for what you're writing? And this devotee said, well, I want this to go out to the general public. And I said, well, the general public is not going to be interested if you're going to use this sort of language. I said, it's not just women. I said, men growing up in modern society are going to recoil from this kind of language. And just because that's what, I said, you're using it because that's what you're comfortable with, because that's what you grew up with. And you're not using it because there's some sort of particular reason to use it. So it took me a while to convince him, but eventually he was convinced. So the particular language in which we present Krishna consciousness, I mean, on a gross level, you know, if you don't speak English, then I can't speak to you in English, or I have to have a translator. And even the particular kind of English, you know, do I use British English? Do I use Australian English? I mean, I remember when I was in the UK, a devotee coming up to me and saying, you can't use the word stupid here in the UK. You know, in America, we'll say, oh, that idea is really stupid. But she said, well, you can't use that. She said, that word here is a very strong word. She said, you can use silly or foolish, but not stupid. And it's like that. You know, even you're speaking in English, you can be fooled and think, well, I'm in another English-speaking country, and they're going to understand the terminology. And, you know, and I've been in other English-speaking countries where I use a word and people look at me and they don't even know what I'm talking about. They'll say, what? Huh? Well, what's that? So the particular words that one uses has to be according to the time, place, and circumstance. The time, the nature of words change in time. And words that were considered very respectful in 1960, you know, maybe those very same words may be considered very disrespectful in 1970. It's just what it is. So this is part of our responsibility as preachers to present Krishna consciousness according to the country, according to the culture, according to the time, according to the particular time. You know, to whom are you speaking? Are you speaking to practicing devotees? I mean, just like one simple example. So I'm putting together seminars on Manashiksha. So in verse 7, Raghunath Das Goswami talks about a dog-eating woman who's dancing in the heart of the devotee. And the exact Sanskrit words basically means that she's unchaste. So many devotees, many times people have translated it as being a prostitute, but he's not using the Sanskrit word for prostitute. You know, and in most of the world, prostitute means a sex worker who specifically goes out looking for customers and charges them. But that's not what Raghunath Das Goswami is saying in this verse. And why is the woman unchaste? Because the woman represents the desire for fame. and the dog she's eating represents fame itself. So if you're looking for fame, you're not constant. You're going to go to whoever is going to give you fame. Right? If somebody stops glorifying you, then you'll leave them. You basically don't have loyalty. Another word could be disloyal, unfaithful. So in thinking about presenting this principle to a non-devotee audience, you know, in our translation, we could call her promiscuous. But I thought, well, that's probably not going to work in the modern society, because being promiscuous is not only socially acceptable in some groups, it's actually considered a good thing. You know, there's a lot of social groups today where the idea is, yeah, you know, try out as many partners as you possibly can before you settle down and marry somebody. And that's the philosophy being taught now to young men and women. And so I think, well, what's another word? You know, the wild woman or the disloyal woman. I mean, that, okay. That's not being loyal.
That's the ultimate question.
You know, loyalty is something that people can relate to. Oh, okay. Someone who's not loyal. But just, what's wrong with having lots of sexual partners, you know? That wouldn't register with a lot of the audiences today. That wouldn't. Then they'd immediately turn you off and say, oh, well, you know, you're just some old fuddy-duddy religious moralist. And then they wouldn't even hear what you had to say. They wouldn't be able to get past that and hear what you have to say. So how exactly we put things in language and how we present to people, you know, is very dependent on the time, place, and circumstance. And to get in there and have them be receptive, and then we can present the principle. And if you can present the principle without changing the principle, you don't want to change the principle. Changing the principle is very dangerous. But as far as the presentation and the language, and, you know, I'm here to preach to you. I don't really want to be preached to, Prabhu. You know, that's even for me, if someone walks in my door and says, okay, Ermila, I'm here to preach to you, it's a little intimidating. If someone says, hey, you know, Ermila, I'd really like to talk to you about some philosophical matters that I think would help you, then, oh, okay, you know, I'm receptive to that. I'll be open to that. Does that make sense?
That's great. But then the question is, though we can adjust our language. What happened to Prabhupada's books in time?
There is no doubt whatsoever that in time there's going to have to be editions of Prabhupada's books with language notes in them. There's no way to avoid it. Just like with Shakespeare. So you can buy Shakespeare without any notes in it at all, and you can buy Shakespeare with annotations that tell you what that word meant at the time that he used it. And as I say, there's words that Shakespeare uses that we look at it and we say, oh, I know what that means. But that's not what he meant. You know, Jai Dorjemaraj makes this point in his book, Vanity Karma, that in Ecclesiastes, first of all, it was translated from Hebrew. So it wasn't originally written in English. But it starts off with vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And he says the word vanity in the modern age means a kind of narcissism and pride in oneself. But that wasn't the original intention at all. It meant everything is vain, in vain. Everything is useless. And the original Hebrew word refers to like vapor or wind. So if you just have the English, you know, all is vanities, you're going to get a different view than what the author intended. And there needs to be some note of what that word meant in the original language. So my guess will be that Srila Prabhupada's books will be available both without annotations, just like Shakespeare's is, and also with annotations. It'll have to be. Because 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now, people will not be speaking the same English that we are speaking today. Who knows if they'll even be speaking English at all? English could become a dead language. Well, you know, we just have no idea. 10,000 years is a long time. That's a very long time. I mean, right now on the planet, there's really only solid recorded history going back 2,000 years. you know, modern historians do not have anything really solid past about 2,000 years. Anything start going back 4,000, 5,000 years, it starts getting really sketchy. So what languages will be on the planet in 1,000 years, in 3,000 years? Who knows? And even if English is still a spoken language, guaranteed it will be different. The meaning of words will be different. We're already having this problem now with Prabhupada's English. Because the English that Srila Prabhupada spoke, especially in the beginning, was English he was trained in by the British about 100 years ago. But his books were edited and put together by Americans who spoke American English, which is not the same in all respects. So we're even having that problem now with some of Prabhupada's words, that, you know, the way people hear them and the way he intended them are not the same. But that will only increase with time. There's no getting away from that. You can't avoid. And Prabhupada wanted his disciples also to produce books. He wanted his disciples not only to translate the books of the Acharyas, but also to produce their own books. And one of the reasons for that is that things have to keep being explained in the current context. You know, a lot of the parables and the analogies change in time. You know, Jesus talked a lot about sheep. I mean, how many of us have sheep? How many of us see sheep? Or even Prabhupada talking about the hot iron rod and the fire. How many of us see iron rods and fire? I mean, do we go to blacksmiths? How many of us visit a blacksmith? I'm sure when Prabhupada grew up, there were blacksmith shops regularly. You know, my father grew up with horses and buggies. He remembers the milk being delivered daily by horse and buggy. So that means there's going to be blacksmith shops and horseshoes, you know, just down the street from you. And everybody, every kid grows up seeing a hot iron rod put into a fire and glowing red hot. But who sees that today? You know, you have to go to a county fair or something. So if you're speaking to a general audience and you say, just like a hot iron rod put in the fire glows red hot, I mean, maybe someone's seen that on a video sometime. But if you say, just like you put a metal pot on your stove and the pot becomes hot, oh, okay, I got that. I understand that. So, you know, things have to be explained in terms that people will be able to relate to in their present circumstance. In fact, Srila Prabhupada says you must change the time, place, and you must adjust. He says you have to. Otherwise, in the name of purity, if you're like, okay, I'm just going to use exactly the same language that Bhaktivinoda Thakur used, I'm going to use the same analogies that Narada Muni used, you know, it might not work. People might just be like, what? What are you talking about?
Mother Urmila.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you a question.
Yes.
But don't you think that even today, the books of Srila Prabhupada are being interpreted? In other words, like for instance, today, you are speaking from Bhagavatam and the purport by Srila Prabhupada.
Yes.
But we are seeing this purport and the meaning of the purport through your eyes, through your own intelligence, or through your own insight.
Yes.
Don't you think that this is going on?
Of course, it has to.
You know, it was that. So at one point, people, do you think that the devotees can make their own realizations on their own, or do they still need to go through advanced devotees in order to understand these books?
Both. Of course we're supposed to come to our own realizations. You know that in sociology of religion, religions that start with a lot of revelations later try to stop anyone from having revelations. They try to make everything rote. Yes, pratyekshavagamam dharmam susukam kartamavyam. We're supposed to have our own realizations and revelations and epiphanies. That's the whole point. If you don't have any vigyan, if you don't have any realization, if you don't attain knowledge, gnaya, And what's the point of everything you're doing? Shama Evihi Kevalam, it's a bunch of, it's useless. But our realization has to be within the purview of Sadhu Shastra Guru, otherwise it's also useless. Yes, our own realizations, but within that purview. It's like you can do so many occupations, but it has to be within the law. You know, if you have some great realization, wow, the way I can make money is by robbing banks. You know, that realization isn't valid. But if you have the realization, wow, you know, I could make money by starting a clothing business. So you can have, you know, practically unlimited personal realizations of how to make your living, but it's got to be within the law. So one can have unlimited personal realizations of how to serve Krishna, and it's got to be within the frame of Sadhu Shastra Guru. And the frame of Sadhu Shastra Guru is not narrow or stereotyped. You don't have to worry that the frame is so small, you know, that everybody's going to end up with the same realizations. As we're individuals, frankly, each of us, in the ultimate sense, will end up with a slightly different realization. As Lord Kapila Dev says, the Lord appears in a different form to each worshiper. So each of us is going to ultimately understand Krishna a little differently, and our own individual relationship is going to be a little different. But it's all within the purview of Sadhu Shastra Guru. It's not going to be rasa basa. Just like when the sages in Dandaka Forest saw Lord Ramachandra, they desired an amorous relationship with him, but he had taken Eka Patni Vrata, so they couldn't have an amorous relationship with Ramachandra. They had to have it with Krishna. To try to have an amorous relationship with Ramachandra is outside the purview of Sadhu Shastra Guru. Same with Lord Chaitanya. Prabhupada talks about the Apa Sampradaya, people who say, well, we're going to be Lord Chaitanya's gopis because he's actually Krishna. And Prabhupada says, you're disturbing Lord Chaitanya's mood. So if someone says, well, that's my real, I have a personal realization that I have a conjugal relationship with Ramchandra or with Lord Chaitanya, you can't do that. Now, you might see Lord Chaitanya or Lord Ramachandra and awaken your conjugal relationship with Krishna, but it has to be done with Krishna. So that's just a simple example that if someone says, well, I have some realization. Okay, but that realization has to be understood through Sadhu Shastra Guru. Does that make sense?
I'm sorry, I had to mute the echo.
Anything else?
Lakshmi has got a question. Also, a lot of things in the chat I'll transfer over from Star Meeting.
Okay.
Mahalakshmi Mataji, we should be able to hear you.
Okay. Thank you really much for your class. And I was, you mentioned that Karama Muni recognized he had a personal desire who would have been better than to have. And, but he only wanted to have it through the Lord. And in which way was the Lord glorified by recognizing that?
How was the Lord glorified for that? First of all, the Lord is truthfulness. So he's glorified by our being truthful. You know, Daksha approaches the Lord for a nice wife and children, but his real motive is just his own sense gratification. And Kardama Muni's approach to the Lord was entirely truthful. So the Lord is glorified and pleased by authenticity. And we see that Kardama Muni helped his wife to come to pure devotional service. He facilitated his daughters being engaged in the service of the Lord, and he became the father of Kapila Dev. So it said that the householder life of Kardama Muni was glorified all over the universe. And every aspect of it gave pleasure to the Lord.
When the devotee
what?
He is pleasing. He is in ways that he are
Yes. And Balabhadra Prabhu says, it seems that coming to our own realizations will lend itself easily to our personal opinions over time, therefore we're supposed to be reading in association. Yes, therefore we're supposed to, that's why we have these classes. That's why we just don't sit in our own rooms reading. That's why we listen to Srila Prabhupada's classes. That's why we study the books of the Acharyas. Was there one other question somebody had? Otherwise, we can end.
I was thinking, if you could clarify the difference between training material attachments and being honest with the Lord that I still have material desires, and let me purify them by devotional service.
Okay, so maintaining material attachments is, I don't want to purify them. I want to keep them. I have no intention of purifying them. Even if I go to the Lord about them, I'm going to the Lord asking him to facilitate me keeping them. That's what Daksha did. He went to the Lord with the intention that the Lord would facilitate him keeping his material desires. Whereas Kardama Muni went to the Lord with the intention that the Lord would help him become purified of those material desires. Now, both Daksha and Kardama wanted to use their household life and children in the Lord's service. But you can see Kardama Muni wanted his wife and children to become fully liberated and pure devotees, whereas Daksha didn't. He got very angry when he had children who became pure devotees. He wanted them to be pious and he wanted them to be devotees, but he wanted them to stay materialistic devotees.
It wasn't his argument that since they renounced when they were so young, they wouldn't be able to maintain the renunciation.
Yes, he did make that argument. He said that they weren't ready to be renounced, that they had to go through that experience. And frankly, that's generally true. So the argument he made is generally true. But he wasn't able to see that in that case it wasn't true. Because Narada Muni was able to perceive that the boys had become so purified by their austerities that they really didn't need it. If Narada Muni had seen that they had needed to go through the Grahastha Ashram, he wouldn't have bothered them. Because he's a perfect preacher according to time, place, and circumstance. But he saw that their austerities had taken them above going through the process of the ashrams. That by engaging, because the austerities were austerities in bhakti, and he could see they've already achieved that. They don't need to do the step by step. You know, a good teacher sees that. You know, I used to teach mathematics with blocks. So there's a block, a very small block that's for ones, and then there's a block that's 10 times that size for a 10, and 100 times that size for 100s. And for the vast majority of children, if they don't use some sort of, we call them manipulatives, if they don't use some sort of object, physical object, that they can move around, they will not get math concepts. So this is the studies, the psychological studies, that human beings go from what they call a concrete to a visual to an abstract. That first they have to touch it, just like little babies, you know, they're always touching things. You know, they have to touch them. Then they can get a internal picture, and then they can just go directly to abstract. You know, when I'm doing 6 times 7, I don't even have a picture in my mind of 6 times 7. I can just reason abstractly. And that human children need to go through these three phases of tactile, visual, and abstract. And that's generally true. But sometimes a kid goes through those stages so quickly at a young age. I mean, I had, in all my years of teaching, I think only 2 students who came at 5 years old and did not need anything even visual, who could already reason mathematically abstractly. And to give those children blocks to play with and blocks to use was just frustrating for them. You know, you could give them a complex math, I'm serious, at 5 years old, you give them a complex mathematical problem, and they could just jump to the answer. Often they didn't even know what steps they took to get that answer. They could just intuitively jump to the answer. And if you said to them, okay, you've got to take these blocks and put them here, that just slowed down their processes. It was an impediment to them. So that may be unusual. It's not common, but it does happen. And the good teacher should be able to see this child doesn't need to go through this step-by-step process. They can immediately jump to a higher level. And, you know, then you just jump that kid right at age five. You know, you're jumping them to the third or fourth year of studies. They just skip over several years of studies. So Narada Muni could see that these sons, that they were ready to jump. They had gotten there already through bhakti. They didn't need to take those steps. And Daksha couldn't see that because he didn't even really understand even the ultimate goal. To him, the ultimate goal was to be a demigod. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada. Ki jai.